everybody. Welcome. Thank you so much for you guys for showing up. We're really excited for today's episode. So my name is Ani Steele. I'm going to be your host today. And we just want to welcome you guys to Craft's inaugural conversation series, The Food Lovers Elective. At Craft, we seek to foster a transformative regional food system in Western Pennsylvania that recognizes the central role of food systems in our society and values of the people who live and work within them. We envision a food system that is equitable, fostering fairness and transparency across the value chain, a system that is sustainable, actualizing economic, social, and cultural well-being as part of the food system, and a food system that is inclusive, valuing dignity, sovereignty, and the inherent power of all people. So with that in mind, this week's episode is called Taste the Place, a conversation about culinary tourism with Rebecca McKenzie. Our moderator for this week is Quayla Allen, food studies graduate student and undergraduate alum of Chatham University. Today, she is interviewing Rebecca McKenzie, the CEO and president of the Culinary Tourism Alliance in Ontario, Canada. Rebecca and Quayla have a wonderful episode for you all, so get ready to learn, be inspired, and have some laughs along the way. This episode will take about an hour with the last 10 to 15 minutes reserved for Q&A. Feel free to submit your questions using the Q&A feature on the bottom of your screen. Also feel free to chat with us, leave comments or encouragement to our moderators or speaker, and just talk to each other. We really want this to be engaging for you guys. Okay. We are very, very excited to have you guys. Please enjoy the episode, and I will hand it off to Quayla and Rebecca.
Hello.
Good morning.
Thank you, Ani, for the awesome introduction. I'm so excited, Rebecca, to be chatting with you today. I feel like we should just get started. I think we're warmed up. We're ready to go. So let's just jump right into it, because you are celebrating 25 years in culinary tourism this year, I believe. And so I wanted to know if you could talk about why culinary tourism and how you got your start at the Culinary Tourism Alliance.
Super. Well, thanks so much for having me today, Quayla. And thanks, Ani, for setting that up. I love the intro music. So great to be with you today. So my career, it kind of took an interesting path and an unexpected path. I, as a teenager, spent my last year of high school sailing through Europe and Africa on a tall ship for 4.5 months. So I was one of 28 students from across Canada, and we started in Copenhagen, Denmark, and finished off in Cape Town, South Africa. And I got to be honest with you, Quayla, I don't know if I've divulged this to you before, but I was actually a really, really picky eater as a kid. And my mom was not a fabulous cook. Like her signature dishes were weenies and beanies on toast and spaghetti. So I think it was my travels, though, that really opened my eyes to the value of food as a way to connect to place. And in fact, I can distinctly recall my very first falafel that I had when I was in Alexandria, Egypt, just as one example. And so when I came home from my travels, I had this entirely new appreciation for food and the way that it really connects us to people and to culture. Kind of move forward another 4 or 5 years, and I found myself living in rural Ontario, about 2 hours east of Toronto, in a place called Prince Edward County, not to be confused with Prince Edward Island. However, it is an island, which is why it gets complicated. So I moved there because I had the opportunity to return to Ontario from British Columbia, where I had been living. And I'd spent all my summers and most of my life in Prince Edward County, because all of my family was from there, my parents, my grandparents. And I was working in the hospitality industry. I was a bartender and a server, but I was saving my money and I was going to go travel the world and have continued great adventures. But I ended up actually meeting a colleague of mine who was starting the very first fruit winery in Prince Edward County. So he was taking over his parents' apple orchard and he was making hard cider. And I was helping him out of this tiny little room on the end of this beautiful home that was his parents' home. And we decided that actually what we would do is take an old pig barn from built in the 1860s and restored and turned it into a tasting room. And I would have my business within his business while continuing to help him run his tasting room. It was called the Wapoose Warehouse, and it was a gourmet Canadian food gift shop. And so what I was doing was finding all of these amazing artisan food and beverage producers, non-alcoholic beverage at the time, because of course he had the cider. But that was my foray into getting into food as a career. And the interesting thing about Prince Edward County is it was at the time in the 90s, a place that really where everybody who owned businesses was trying to make enough money in June, July, and August when the tourists came, and mm-hmm. then figure out how to live the other 9 months of the year. And as a result, we had about 100 entrepreneurs from across the island come together to sort of talk about how could we do better? How could we work together to actually see a longer season and really try to help the economy thrive and grow? And I ended up founding an organization called Taste the County. And it ended up being a destination development organization that I ran for 10 years. And we developed things like the Taste Trail, maple in the county, the celebration of the first harvest of the year, maple syrup. We did Taste, a celebration of regional cuisine. And I did a number of other tourism assets like our arts trail and our birding festival as an example. But it was through that I really got to work very closely with all the businesses along the culinary tourism value chain. And I actually just noted in your opening statement, you talk a lot about value chains. So for those listening, when we talk about culinary tourism, and as you know, Quayla, it's way more than dining. So it's everything from like going to a farm and having an on-farm experience to visiting a farmer's market or an added value food and beverage processor like a cheese dairy or a winery or cidery. Of course, everything from food trucks to fine dining, accommodations through the lens of their food and beverage, attractions that may tell the food ways of a destination or the culture and history of food and agriculture, as well as festivals and events and culinary tours. So it was through that experience of 10 years doing that I ended up being asked to participate in developing a provincial strategy back in 2005. And so I contributed the festivals and events chapter to the provincial culinary tourism strategy. And then about 2 years later, I got sucked into joining the board as a volunteer and helped to raise about $750,000 to implement the 10-year strategy on behalf of the province. And lo and behold, then they posted a job and I applied for that, and that was now, this will be over 13 years. So super exciting journey that I've had, but not sort of the typical path to get where you might think you would get just by way of a lot of hard work, trial and error, and really just getting engaged with the community. It's been a fun ride.
I love that. That's really exciting. And it's good to know that, you know, our entry points can all be different and we can still come into something that can make an impact in our community. So thanks for sharing that. I think you touched on this. You were starting to touch on this towards the end, but can you contextualize like where CTA kind of sits in the food ways and the food systems in Ontario? And I know you're like starting to branch out a little bit, but like, who do you engage with? You know, who are you working with in the space?
Yeah, so the Culinary Tourism Alliance, while it started as an organization to implement the 10-year strategy, it evolved over time. Initially we were sort of under the umbrella of another not-for-profit organization, the Ontario Restaurant Hotel Motel Association, and our name was actually the Ontario Culinary Tourism Alliance, or as OCTA, as lots of people love to just, you know, turn around and make acronyms out of things, right? So from 2006 until 2015, we were primarily focused on servicing Ontario businesses, working with destination marketing organizations, sector groups, commodity groups, and all of the businesses along the culinary tourism value chain. We successfully completed the strategy, which is not often that a government strategy gets adopted by industry and fully executed, but we did that. And in 2016, we actually dropped our O, recognizing that we were getting hired by different destinations to come in and help them create very specific strategies for them to realize the development of culinary tourism in their destination. So our organization actually does three main things, and I'm very, very lucky, Aquela. I have an amazing team. I have an awesome staff. So we have a whole destination development staff, and that team works with not only destination development organizations, but also community economic development officers, ag groups, you know, specialty groups, to create strategies, to develop products, to do capacity building with the industry. And so as an example, right now, we're working with Faulcha Ireland on developing their national framework for culinary trails in Ireland. We helped Scotland develop their culinary tourism strategy for the country. Right now, in the last year, of course, COVID changed in-person workshops to virtual workshops, but we've worked coast to coast to coast. So literally from Newfoundland, Labrador, all the way up to the Northwest Territories and over to BC, with destinations and communities through a program called Elevating Canadian Experiences that's been led by our National Tourism Industry Association. And then the second sort of department in the organizations are marketing and communications. So we actually have a consumer website, OntarioCulinary.com. And that's where you can go and learn how to do something delicious in the province. And we highlight all of the great tastes that you can experience here in the province. We also do really cool things like we worked with the world's 50 best restaurants to bring them to Canada for the very first time and create a video series called The World's 50 Best Restaurants. And right now we're actually executing the largest culinary tourism or the largest COVID recovery program through the lens of culinary tourism called the Great Taste of Ontario. And we have over 90 investing partners from municipalities to organizations like Wine Country Ontario and Ontario Craft Brewers and Dairy Farmers of Ontario. And we've raised funds from both federal government as well as Ministry of Tourism and Ministry of Agriculture. So for your listeners, that's something that's really important to consider if you're thinking about getting into culinary tourism, is you do need to actually understand the complexity of it. And you do need to understand all of the elements. So, you know, you need to understand and appreciate farming and added value food and beverage processing, as much as understand hospitality and tourism. The last department that we have is our programs team. And we have a really interesting program we developed in 2013 and went live to the public with, called Feast On, a Certified Taste of Ontario. And we actually work with restaurants to audit them based on their procurement of Ontario grown and raised ingredients for them to achieve certification. And through the program, we actually do a ton of education and networking on the back end to connect them with farmers and added value food and beverage processors who have the capacity to sell into the restaurant industry, because we want to see more Tastes of Ontario on consumer plates and in consumer glasses. In addition, that team is also now working on a new culinary cultural diversity program that we hope to launch later this year after some more engagement with the industry to help us in the development.
Awesome. Awesome. I love you. We were just thinking about COVID and how that has shifted businesses and their direction. And I think, you know, I'm interested to know how the Great Taste of Ontario has evolved since. I know that it launched last year, and really because Canada has been very like closed to the rest of the world, you know, it sounds like it was a economic recovery for locals and really getting locals out into the community and thinking of them as tourists. So can you talk about how that shift took place and how that will continue to evolve?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's interesting, Kuala, you know, our very early days, I realized that when we were going to be allowed to start moving again, and just so you know, Toronto is still in lockdown. So we've actually been in a pretty sort of restrictive frame of lockdown since December. And for restaurants, as an example, in Toronto area, out of the last 365 days, they have been open for just over 100. Mm. So times are still very challenging here. And so globally, though, you're seeing destinations who've chosen to, you know, take the measures to close their borders to try to manage the spread of the disease. And so in April last year, what I realized is that when we can open, we would need to be hyper focused on local and our own domestic product. And that, you know, hopefully, as time progressed, we'd be able to open to other Canadian provinces and then to the world. So the Great Taste of Ontario started with me really engaging with a lot of our different stakeholders to say, hey, we need to come together and figure out how, when we're allowed to do this, we can affect change in the most positive way, because this is an opportunity for a paradigm shift, both in tourism and in the food system. So the Great Taste of Ontario is really focused on moving Ontarians across Ontario, getting them to fall back in love with all of the places that they either knew or didn't know about, so that they can fall in love with all of the destinations. For your listeners, 8 Irelands fit into the province of Ontario. It is a massive, massive province. I think from one end, from the farthest south to the farthest north that you can drive is about 15 hours. And then there's still a whole chunk of the province that's only fly-in, right? So the program is based on this really cool platform called Bandwango, and it's a passport program where when consumers do get out and start traveling, they actually can check in by into different communities. It geotags them so they can check in and start building loyalty points. There's all sorts of ideation or dreamscape itineraries for people to figure out where they can go and, you know, how they can make a day at a weekend or preferably a longer stay. And those points when they check in are actually built around loyalty points that will enable them to redeem for not only some really, really cool made in Ontario products like an Otter Creek charcuterie board, they can also redeem for vouchers to dine at Feast On certified restaurants. So the money is all going back into the Ontario economy and back to those businesses that have really, really been heavily impacted. We also recognize that that tourism is taking a step backwards in terms of it's being democratized. Like, there's going to be so many people who can't afford to get out and travel. So we want to be able to provide those that don't have the ways and means with, direction on where they can go, that they can have experiences with their families, friends, and loved ones that aren't expensive, but also recognizing that in this time, we've seen an increased demand on, for food access, right? So people that are really having a challenge to be able to put food on their own home plates. So the loyalty points will also be redeemed to give cash donations to both Food Share and Second Harvest, which are two amazing charities that are not only doing great work in terms of food access, but also food justice. So of course, as I mentioned, we're in a lockdown. So we actually had to put a pause on the program back in December because our Minister of Tourism put stay home orders in place. And so that meant no marketing. Mm. And so we're hoping that come May, our plans are in May, that we'll relaunch the program and we'll run it through to the end of next March. And we're going to be including things like different influencers that will go out and get content and cover really interesting experiences. There's a whole digital and a print campaign. So there's lots to come. And I think we feel very strongly that this is going to be not only a great way to see and help and support an economic recovery, but really continue to educate Ontarians and through that education, help to make that kind of transformative change that we need to see.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely a blessing to be able to, occupy space, pre-COVID, during COVID. And so, even thinking post-COVID, when the economy is recovered and whatnot, I think there's a lot of content out there. There's a lot of articles. I think I mentioned the End of Tourism article in the Guardian, how people are seeing this shift to more sustainable tourism overall. And so knowing that there is that tension, right? I think you had mentioned this before with Prince Edward County and mm-hmm. and how tourism or visitors and locals are clashing in such, I guess to be expected to some extent. And so I guess I wanted to know how you are preparing for the next phase post-COVID and really alleviating some of those tensions and making more tourism more sustainable in the Ontario overall.
Yeah, I think the situation that we have here is not unique to the province of Ontario or to Canada. In fact, we're seeing this in destinations around the world. So it's that resident sentiment. So it's really about, because there's hotspots in our province and then there's the rest of the province who, as an example, right now you can go to different communities outside of the city of Toronto and you can eat inside a restaurant. Like, I haven't eaten inside of a restaurant since last fall, early last fall.
Yeah.
And people are doing that. And so it's this fine balance, because the businesses need the business, but also these smaller communities that don't have the numbers in terms of the COVID numbers are kind of saying, hey, like, please don't come until it's safe. Or if you're going to come, only come if you're coming from another destination that where, you know, you're in a different level of lockdown. So, you know, really our approach is around communications and doing as much as we can to help support communications. We've worked really closely with our Tourism Industry Association of Ontario around getting businesses to achieve the Safe Travel Stamp. This is a stamp that's actually been implemented by the World Travel and Tourism Council to really give consumers the assurance that the business operators are adhering to the highest level of safety protocols. Because even once we see sort of more of a mass vaccination, I don't think you're going to see things like social distancing really disappear for quite a while, because there's going to continue to be nervousness about how long does the vaccine last? What are the, you know, the variants, that kind of thing. So, you know, I know it's really stressful for so many business operators, and especially in urban centers where places like Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver, you know, their core audience is an international audience. And you think about all, like, there isn't any meetings and conventions happening in Toronto this year. And that's huge. Those are, you know, literally thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who come, you know, for business. They linger, they spend, you know, they keep the economy going. Similarly, you know, even here in the downtown core, many of our office buildings don't have anybody working in them because, you know, we've all shifted to this virtual workspace. So there's going to be it's going to be a long time for the recovery. I don't think that anybody is fooling themselves that, you know, we're just going to switch a light on and everything will go back to being normal. But to your point, you know, Kwela, this is the time for many destinations to say, okay, how do we start to make changes now, especially in places that are have been experiencing over tourism. So there's a really great article I just read about Hawaii as an example, who's looking at how do they adjust how they manage tourism so that they can ensure that they not only meet the needs in terms of the economic goals, but more importantly look at how they measure health through the residents perspective and make sure that there's a balance between the environment and the social along with the economic.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So shifting gears just a little bit, as you know, I'm calling in from a master's program, and you yourself are also in a master's program. So I wanted to know how, if you could talk about what you're doing, what you're studying, and how that is eventually going to influence your culinary tourism work as well.
Thanks. Yeah. So I'm actually doing a Master of Arts in Global Leadership at Royal Roads University, which is in Victoria, British Columbia, on the other coast of the country. And in fact, you and I met through LinkedIn, I think it was. You reached out to a colleague of mine who said, actually, you should talk to Rebecca. And then I found out you're taking your course. And it's been actually, you know, I have to say, Kwela, there's silver linings to everything. And one of the silver linings for me in the past year is getting to meet you and actually make a new friend online during a pandemic.
Yes.
But we really have been learning from each other. And that really for me was sort of, you know, I'm 46. I don't have a formal education. You know, I have a high school diploma. I took a year of a pre-engineering technology college course. But, you know, I just kind of went right into the workforce. And what I realized is that I don't know what I don't know. And that's what kind of inspired me to take this course. And it's been absolutely incredible. So I've been able to really learn about how to deal with crisis at a global level. And actually, everything I've been learning, I've been applying in real time during this crisis. So I'm just actually at the point where I'm starting my capstone. So unlike other masters that have a thesis, our program has a capstone, which is an applied project. And I'm actually going to go into my home community of Prince Edward County and look at creating a strategy to find balance and improve the communications and engagement between our provincial park, our municipality, and our residents, because there's a lot of tension in and there's a lot of disconnect in terms of how to actually go about managing over tourism, which, you know, it's been an ongoing issue that's only been exacerbated by COVID-19. So again, because we're only 2.5 hours from Toronto, I just found out last year on July 4th weekend, the park turned away 2,000 cars.
Oh, wow.
The closest community doesn't even have 2,000 people living in it. So it's like literally picking up that community and saying, go somewhere else. And as a result of people being turned away, they went to other conservation areas and smaller parks that didn't have that, you know, infrastructure to handle it. So we saw lots of waste. We saw lots of, you know, bad behavior in terms of parking and spots that weren't intended for parking. We saw bad behavior on behalf of the residents who you know, were vocalizing like, go home. So there was a lot of issues. We're also seeing real estate here is going through the roof in Canada, and the number of people who are looking to escape the city and go to rural areas is driving the cost of housing up, so that many rural residents can't access. So it's, what I'd like to say is that, you know, it's certainly not in the worst crisis. There's many other places in the world that are under, you know, much more significant levels of crisis, but in and of itself, it is experiencing crisis, and it's a very complex issue. And it's my studies that's really going to help me take a systems approach using appreciative inquiry and action research that I've been learning through my studies to try to find a solution that's going to help.
Yeah. I was just thinking, wasn't the mayor one of the people who got told to go home because he like didn't have the, they thought he was from Toronto? That cracked me up a little bit.
Yeah, a local mayor was out. He was actually not the mayor. He was the member of council for one of the communities, and he was out delivering mail in people's mailboxes, and he had a license plate frame that said, you know, something from Toronto. And one of the locals like pulled over and like yelled at him, told him to go back to Toronto. And he's like, yeah, I'm your member of a municipal council. Thanks. So, you know, but that's just one example. Like you know, again, we're hearing it everywhere. So, you know, in terms of finding balance, I think, you know, for so long, so many destinations have been focused on measuring success by heads and beds and by that international visitor. And so I think, you know, it was interesting. I attended a UNWTO webinar series last week on sustainable development. And it's really, we have to shift our mindset on what does success look like. And I know Susan's asking in the chat, like, how do you balance between environmental, social, and economic? And really, I think it's in the process of defining what measurements for success look like. And, you know, go beyond the economic, go beyond the heads and beds or the bums and seats, but really look at how do you improve the quality of life for the residents? How do you, for example, through developing food tourism, ensure that there's food access and food security? How do you create relationships that can be much more resilient during shocks such as COVID or environmental shocks or economic shocks? So a lot of the work that we've done, for example, is we created a whole series called Farmer to Chef's Meet and Greets, where we've actually gone into communities over the last 12 years and we do speed dating for farmers. Because we, you know, our food systems have evolved so much because of how they're globalized and industrialized that for many years, you know, farmers could grow and raise products and literally send them to either a commodity group or to a distributor who then is taking it direct to the food service. And the food service operator, the chef or the head of procurement doesn't even know who the farmer is. And similarly, there's many chefs who have never, you know, for example, broken down a whole animal because they, you know, they took that out of a lot of educational programs. They're now putting it back in the last 5 years, but they didn't learn, they weren't taught how to butcher an animal or make cheese or bake artisan breads. Like those are things that are just coming back into the system. So when these farmer to chef meet and greets, and they've been so much fun, like you would love them. What we do is we typically put the farmers on one side of the room in seats, and then we take chefs and they sit across from them. The chefs are the ones that keep moving down until you've gone all the way through. But you typically use like a cowbell and it's 5 minutes. Oh my goodness. Sitting in front of that farmer, sitting in front of that chef, and you have a conversation. And it's just through that moderated introduction and conversation that new business, new partnerships are created. And it's so meaningful and it has made incredible change.
That's amazing. That sounds so fun.
Mm-hmm.
Alice has a question. So she's interested in knowing how we address those who benefit from tourism, economically live off of it, but don't live in the spaces, like bigger entities of like hotels, airlines, and whatnot. And particularly food writers, journalists who are distant, but end up making the space into a destination. So she's thinking a lot about how the best restaurant or the eater's heat map, for instance, lists and what it does to a place. And sure, it brings in money overall, but what about the impact?
Yeah, you know, that's a really great question. And so it's interesting because there was just an article, actually, I think if it wasn't in Eater, it was in one of the other popular digital spaces, travel and food spaces, that was talking about the fact that, you know, Canada doesn't have Michelin star here. And do we need that? And you know, why don't we have that? Well, at the end of the day, it's a marketing platform, and it's a, you know, they generate revenue by being able to go in either through advertising sales or through destination support to send in their auditors who, you know, will review a destination's dining and then determine if there's enough of them to start actually rating the systems. So it's all a business model, just like the world's 50 best restaurants. I mean, at the end of the day, the travel writers, they are writing for a publication. So yes, they are doing a service and they can make or break a destination, quite frankly. But you know, it's interesting, as an example, Prince Edward County just got put on two other lists by two travel and food, very well-known travel and food publications. And in a sense, they're like, oh no, like this isn't what we don't want more people to know about us, because they're like, we're in a crisis. It's fine if those people came in December or February or March or November. But the reality is that from May to October, they're at capacity. And so, you know, it is really thinking about that balance. And you know, I have to say, full disclosure, the reason why I'm picking this community as to do my capstone in it, I feel sort of responsible that I created this mess by getting what was known as Ontario's best kept secret and turning it into one of the hottest culinary tourism spots in the country. But the reality is that, you know, I can take some blame for it, but the municipality also needs to realize that they should have had a longer term strategic plan on how to manage traffic flow, on how to manage accommodation taxes, on how to manage temporary or short-term vacation rentals. You know, the influx of Airbnb has completely shifted the whole accommodation matrix. And at the same time, the provincial park needs to really rethink how they manage both day use visitors and then the longer term visitors, and how the impact of the park has this ripple effect on an entire community. But that's really where taking a whole systems approach is so important. And often in many destinations, tourism doesn't speak to transportation. Transportation doesn't speak to health. Health might not speak to, you know, the business community. And so decisions, when they're made, if you don't think through all the other touch points, can cause this ripple that creates the chaos, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you bring up a good point, because American Express just released their travel trends for 2021. And one of them was culinary tourism is here to stay, which was great to see, but also the rise of the second city. And so folks who may have gone to Lisbon, right, are now looking for Porto. And I think a lot of that is in response to, you know, the pandemic, but really the reality to what you were speaking to is that a lot of these destinations don't have the infrastructure to then become the next hotspot.
So, you know, what's interesting though, is looking at those places that are hotspots and thinking creatively about how, rather than to market yourself, is market your neighbor destination that's not as busy and say, look, we'd love to have you come here. but we're really, really busy this time of year. So if you don't have a reservation, please don't just show up on our door. Here's some other places you could go to that have great tastes as well, have great beaches, have great attractions. And then come to us, come and see us in December, or, you know, make sure you book now for next March, right? This idea that spread the wealth. And I think, you know, I was really excited to see the American Express piece say that 64% of Americans are interested in traveling for taste of place. But part of this is where, you know, when we work with destinations, we really talk about making sure that this is more than a marketing effort. It has to be mindful. You really do need to work with the businesses to make sure that they have the capacity to meet the consumer expectation. And you and I, you've heard my analogy, is that I believe that your local should be your bread and butter and your tourists be your gravy. And when you create a destination that is solely for a tourism experience, you do tend to forget about your residents, and that's where chaos begins. You know, there's another interesting model in Italy where they're actually taking and reopening spaces that are not, you know, typical accommodation spaces, spaces that have actually been abandoned, and creating pop-up accommodations with them to try to push people away from hotspots like Venice and get them to explore the undiscovered. And I can say with a great deal of honesty, as somebody who travels a lot, in fact, this has been a really bizarre experience to be grounded for an entire year. I was traveling the year before, I had 100 days of travel. That's not 100 days that I was away. That was 100 days that I was either in a plane, a train, or an automobile somewhere, right? I look for the places that haven't been discovered now. I want to go where nobody else is going. I want to, and when I go, I want to spend more time there. I want to connect with the locals. I want to learn about their culture. I want to learn about their food. And I want my stay to have a positive impact. Yeah. So it's this whole concept of regenerative tourism as well, really encouraging people that if you are going to go somewhere, make sure that your impact is one that's positive and more than just the economic piece, right?
Absolutely. I appreciate that. And I really love, you know, some of the tips around like going back to things you've done to say, hey, like I did the best I could then, and now I feel compelled to go back and fix whatever things that I may have done wrong. And I think, you know, just the level of care and thought that you are putting into this is really amazing. And as somebody who, you know, I'm a product of a women's college, I see these as attributes of women, my own bias. I recognize that. Luckily this is being recorded, so people know that that's my bias, but you know, it's our, it's Women's History Month here, in the States. And so I wanted to know what relationships have you been able to form with other women in the field, and how has that kind of shaped your experience? And what tips would you have for other women who are listening who want to go into this work?
Well, I'm very fortunate that I've worked with a lot of amazing women over my career, and you know, from a mentor of mine who sadly she passed away suddenly last fall from cancer, Anita Stewart. She was sort of our matron of culinary in Canada. She founded an event called Food Day Canada. Anita was an incredible inspiration, and it's kind of sad how there's days where I'm like, oh, I got to call Anita about that, and I go, wow, yeah, she's gone. And you know, but one of my best friends, Arlene Stein, she's the founder of the Terroir Symposium. I met her through our mutual passion for the slow food movement, which certainly as a co-founder of our slow food convivium in Prince Edward County, I've met some amazing women from all walks, from tourism to cheesemakers to winemakers. I've got good friends around the world that I've met through the slow food movement and through the Terroir Symposium. You know, last 2019, I came to California and did the Chef Cycle Ride. I was one of 10 Canadians that put together a Canadian team, and we rode 100 miles a day for 3 days in a row to raise money for No Kid Hungry. And I remember the day before the ride, I went for a test ride. Full disclosure, I had never ridden my bike outside before then. I'd been training all winter on a base in this gym. So I get there and I didn't realize I didn't had my clips in too tight, so I couldn't clip out. And we went for this ride, about 25 of the riders, just to kind of make sure that you knew how to ride in a pack and do all this stuff. And we got paired up, and I was riding with this woman, Elizabeth. And I kept on falling because they would be like, okay, stop. And I'm like clipping out, but I couldn't. So I was crashing, and she was so great. We bonded immediately. Well, it's Elizabeth Faulkner, and she's, you know, she's a force to be reckoned with as a chef in the US and doing amazing work. She's actually living in LA, but she'd been in New York for a while. And it was like Elizabeth who got me through those 3 days and stood by me and was cheered me on. And she was much fitter than I am. But just like one example, and, you know, even meeting you is just another example of these great women that I get to, that I've met through my career. I also have amazing women on my team. So, you know, one of my longest standing team members, Agatha, she's our director of communications. She actually came to me, she has a journalism degree, but she's a passionate cook. And she took the culinary program at George Brown and came to me as an intern over a decade ago. So, you know, but also Valerie, who's one of our newest management team members, she did a master's in agri-foods, you know, just like fascinating. Our most recent team member, Nastasha Ali, she's actually a food blogger. She's originally from the Philippines, and she's now a new research and engagement coordinator. But, you know, like I've got like these great women on the team who came from very, very different educational backgrounds. So not what you would expect.
Yeah.
The core thing is they're everybody who works with us is passionate about food, loves to travel, but is also very creative and entrepreneurial. Because as a not-for-profit organization, I saw one of the questions that came up from Cynthia sort of saying, do you feel supported by locals, government, public spaces to center residents rather than tourists? Or is this something that's evolving? I think it is, but it's tough because, you know, even the UNWTO measures success by international visitors and business that's coming to a destination. And so many times those in tourism, they're so fixated on that they kind of get away from what's best for the residents. I hope that this crisis and this shock that the industry has felt because of the pandemic will start to really shift that and get people to think about things in a different way, specifically government and municipalities. But it's going to take change from organizations like ourselves and industry to demand that kind of change as well, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are coming up to the 15-minute mark. And so I wanted to invite some more questions. You could do it in the chat or the Q&A. And I think, you know, before we turn it over to some of the audience questions, I think my last one is really, I meant you've had a rich career in culinary tourism with many, you know, great triumphs and trials and missteps and wins along the way. And so I wanted to know, like, what are the greatest lessons you've learned in this? And, you know, what should we think about for those who are interested in a career in culinary tourism, think about as we embark on that journey?
Sure. So first and foremost, volunteer. I think that for me, I've done a lot of volunteering over the years, and that's really where my opportunities have come from, is because of the network that I've created. I would also say that, like, I'm a firm believer in failure, and that the only downside to failure is if you fail and you don't learn from it. You know, the expression, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. So, you know, I'm open to risk and taking risk, because I'm also open to the fact that if I fail, then at least I tried.
Yeah.
And, but you know, I don't go into anything lightly. I spend a lot of time researching. I also know that I am not the smartest person in the room, and there's lots of people who know a lot of great things. And so instead of assuming something, is I find the person, I find the expert, I reach out on LinkedIn, I get their email, I call them, and I engage and I ask. And, you know, it's one of the things that I teach a lot of the businesses I coach is, you know, if the wheel's already spinning for somebody else, don't try to recreate a whole new wheel. Get in touch with them, figure out how their wheel spins, and then figure out how to take and put your own spokes back into that wheel, or put a different tread on the wheel. Like, yeah. Do it that way, because, you know, it's remarkable what you can achieve. And I also think, like, really thinking outside the box for the type of people that you can work with and that you can collaborate with is really, really important. And constantly self-improving. You know, the amount of growth that I've seen in myself, even in the last 18 months since I started my master's, is pretty huge. And in fact, one of my cohorts, she actually got all of us last year when we were in residency to write a letter to our future selves. And I got it last week. It made me cry. I was like, oh my gosh, like past me, future me did it. You know, I was like, yay me. But past me was like, wow, you really knew what you were thinking you wanted to achieve. And it's, you know, it's so important to write down what you want and to vocalize what you want. And the last thing I would say is read Don Miguel's The Four Agreements, because those are the tenets that I try to live by. And they're hard, you know, but it's they're definitely very, very worthwhile. So
can you share those agreements with us?
So first of all, is be impeccable with your word. So when you're putting things out there, you know, even be impeccable with your word to yourself. Because if you doubt yourself, or if you, you know, you don't, you're not kind to yourself, it'll be very hard for others to do the same with you. The other one is don't make assumptions. You know, make sure, you know, that you take the time to ask the questions and to communicate. The one of the ones that's the most difficult is don't take things personally. And that's probably the hardest one for me, because I'm very, very passionate. And then the last is to just do your best, you know, just always every day, wake up, just trying to do your best. And just, you know, and at the end of the day, if you had a bad day, just remember tomorrow's a reset. And to ask for help. And, you know, the power of good communications is so huge. I have teenagers, believe me, I'm like, oh my gosh. But, you know, actually I printed off the four agreements and put them beside the fridge when my oldest son was suffering from depression and panic attacks last fall. And I said, you know, Jack, like, just take some breaths and just read these over again. And you know, it's amazing. Like at 18, he has way more wisdom than I ever had, but my parents never had those conversations with me, right? So yeah. It really is good communications.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. We have a question in the chat. It's how can we balance between finding the hidden gems and not exploiting it to the point where we have over tourism in that area?
Ani, that's a great, great question. And, you know, certainly what is super challenging is as you see destinations create the Instagrammable spot, you know, the how everybody's like, well, this is how we're going to get known, is like you create these places that everybody's going to take pictures of, and then all of a sudden everybody goes there. I think we as consumers need to be more conscientious about how we consume. And then for those that are in a development space, whether that's through community economic development or through destination development or destination marketing, is really trying to be mindful of the stories that you tell, be mindful of the story, who you tell the stories to, be selective even with the media that you host, because as much as they can be powerful and positive, too much of a good thing can be bad, as we all know. Believe me, I love fried chicken sandwiches. And right now I'm like, I can't have one every week. So I really want one. So it's about, you know, I think, the reality is, though, is that there are still a lot of hidden gems. So as a destination that reaches a space of critical success, how do you then start thinking about your neighboring destinations and really working with them to push some visitation to them, recognizing that having a region that is more successful makes the pie bigger and everybody's getting a slice rather than you trying to be the whole pie.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the group?
Ani, yes, a lot of your plate, job, school, family. Are you expecting, you know what, 100%, Ani, I'd love to be a mentor. I have a rule. I have two rules. If anybody ever reaches out to me that wants to ask questions or wants to interview me, I take it, regardless of how busy I am. I also have a rule that if I ever interview anybody for a job, even if they don't get it, I follow up with an email to say, hey, you know, really great to meet you. We've chosen another candidate. And I say, you know, why they didn't get it. Maybe if I, like, you know, you could strengthen your future opportunities through maybe getting a bit more experience in this space or consider volunteering. You know, I know, especially as a woman in this space, and this is something that I really want to see change, is, you know, here in Canada, the tourism industry is largely led by white men, and with women doing the work under them. And so it has been very, very hard, even for me. For many, many years, I was known as the crazy culinary tourism girl when I would go to national tourism meetings, because everyone's like, food. Nobody goes to a place for food. And now, you know, like 20 years later, I'm like, I was right. But, you know, I had a lot of times when I was kicked down and I was made to feel really, really not smart. You know, I was spoken to in ways that, you know, weren't acceptable, and treated in ways that wasn't acceptable. And I can only imagine how that must be for people of color. And, you know, I think to myself, wow, we got to do better. Like, we got to lift each other up. It's a new day. It's a younger generation. And anything I can do to support people who need it, I'm here. So Ani, count me in.
I love that. Thank you, Ani. I wish she was on camera so we could see her big smile right now.
Well, I feel it. I did request to follow you on Instagram, Ani. So let's start there.
Well, if we don't have any other questions, we are typically ending our conversation series with a lightning round questions. And so I have a few for you. So these are going to go really quickly.
Okay.
I did not share these with you, so you do have to think on your toes.
Okay.
Okay. So first, three foods you can't live without.
Three foods I can't live without. Eggs. I have eggs every day in some way, shape, or form. Cheese. I love cheese, every kind of cheese. And you know what? I love lettuce. I do. I mean, I know it sounds boring, but like, I love a good salad. Like, I'll have, like, and not just lettuce, but like greens. Right. Okay. Now I'm really, really big into these sunflower sprouts that I have, when I drizzle with a little bit of like really, really beautiful olive oil, and I'll just have that with my omelet in the morning. But I love greens. So I would say those three things for me. Yeah.
I know. All right. First destination after lockdown.
Oh, New Brunswick. My dad lives there. I haven't seen my dad since last February. And he is, like, honestly, I'm going to cry. He's one of my favorite human beings in the world. And
oh my goodness.
Yeah. I'm going to go see him.
Yes. People who know me know that my dad is my person too. So I feel that a lot.
Well, just a quick sidebar, I actually did the culinary tourism strategy for the province of New Brunswick, and where he lives. And so it's also like, every time I go there, they have amazing oysters. So we do like total oyster nights, and then they have lobster. So my stepmom makes the world's best lobster roll. It's a great culinary tourism destination. In fact, I think it's one of Canada's best undiscovered gems. So I can encourage other people that when you get a chance to come to Canada, don't miss out on New Brunswick, because not only has it got a great taste of place, but the people are awesome.
Amazing. That'll be my first destination after lockdown.
Well, come with me.
Yes. Go to cocktail during girls' night.
Yeah, margaritas. Yeah, but you know what? I have to say, it's like asking me which one is my favorite son. It is really hard, because I really do feel like I'm a seasonal, situational drinker.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, you know, but I do love a mean Aperol spritz. And there's times when that gin and tonic is just perfect. But, you know, I do love a margarita.
Love it. Favorite snack for when you're feeling lazy?
Oh, you know what? Kettle potato chips. Like, they're my vice. I love salty and crunchy. I'm not a sweet person. So yeah, like, that's my go-to sinful treat.
So with that, it sounds like you do salt on the rim with your margaritas.
Yes. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Dream dinner date for someone who's either living or dead.
Oh boy, wow, that's a tough one. My dream dinner date. Oh, You know, it's funny. I was thinking about this. It's so strange because as much as I've had some amazing female mentors, there's been a lot of strong men in my life. And I'd have to say, like, if I could have one dinner again, I'd have dinner with my Gumpy, my grandfather, my dad's dad. He was sassy as anything. And I feel like he would be so, so proud of me. And if we could just sit down and talk about everything that's happened in the last 24 years, we'd have a great time. But yeah. You know what? I've got a lot of really amazing people in my life. So that's a tough question too.
It is. My go-to are Freddie Mercury and Beyonce. I call it the dinner with two queens. That's
wow.
That's
I feel that's amazing, but I feel like you got some time to think about that one. and I was put on the hot spot. You know what? I'd come to your dinner because that would be outstanding. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I would. All right. The last question. So this is controversial within our cohort right now. So you are actually going to be a tiebreaker between me and Ani. Okay, ready?
Okay.
Crinkle cut fries or straight cut fries?
Straight cut fries, but I like them to be like the kind where they still have the skin on. Like they're like, you know, you're taking and you're putting them right in the press. And you can Google Jamie Kennedy. He's a famous chef here in Canada. And he has JK fries. And his fries are, because they're not too thick, they're a thinner. Mm-hmm. Like, but he does them and then he tosses them in this amazing like salt and herb mixture, and then he makes like house-made aiolis that are just over the top. Like to me, it's like kind of sinful, and because you also know it's fresh made, and to me the crinkle cut is like a little bit too processed.
Okay, Ani, but we still love you. You still got a mentor out of this, so you're supported by the group. But I just needed this for myself.
I also feel like you had an advantage because you had a Canadian and isn't like poutine, like big there. I feel.
Yeah. In fairness, actually, and Jamie's poutine is also outstanding. But you know, the only time you see really crinkle cut fries here is at fast food joints. Like it's not something that you see in like a small mom and pop or something like that. So, and I have a rule in my house that I've never bought my kids McDonald's because it's like rental food. It goes in one end and out the other and leaves nothing good. So having said that, I'm like, okay, I also love me a really mean fried chicken sandwich, which sometimes you get, the ones I get, I don't get from fast food. They're all independents, but yeah, I'm trying to even remember the last time I had a crinkle cut fry. Like a long time ago, Ani. Sorry.
I know, it's okay. I'm finding that I'm in the minority, but you know what? I will stand strong. Listen. And I will support my crinkle.
I will be an ally to you. You know I am.
You know, in all fairness, like if we were going out together and you got me a pitcher of margaritas and some crinkle cut fries, I'd be in heaven.
So at the end of the day, a potato is a potato. That's the important part that we're trying to get at.
You know, I do love potatoes. Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Rebecca, for this amazing chat and just for all the lessons and everything. You've been wonderful. I'm so grateful for you. And yeah, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Kwayla and Ani and Cynthia for hosting me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. For those that want to connect, I'm also on Instagram at Canada Culinary is how you can find me. And stay in touch. And I'm really, really excited to see where your careers go. And I'm really excited to see you make it through the rest of your program. And I'm also really excited to have a culinary adventure with you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And everybody, thank you guys for joining our third episode of the Food Lovers Elective, a craft conversation series. Again, thank you so much to Rebecca for the wisdom and knowledge and just I am woman, hear me roar-ness that you brought to this conversation. It was a pleasure learning from you. And thank you, Kwayla, for sharing your mentor with me. I know I kind of slid in there, but that's in response to you sliding in the crinkle cut and the string.
You're right.
I feel like there has to be a give and take. But also, thank you, Kwayla, for bringing Rebecca to our attention and also just bringing such class and I don't know, just bring such class to everything that you do and such thoughtfulness. I really appreciate what you did for this episode. Like Rebecca said, you can follow her at Canada Culinary, and then at Culinary Tourism Alliance as well. So thank you guys. Chatham community, if you want to see what it takes to be in Clayless Seat as a student moderator for future episode, please click the link posted in the chat to fill out the submission form. You can also email us at craft@chatham.edu for further information. If you have suggestions for further guests or topics, feel free to access that link as well. Please take a few minutes afterwards. The survey should pop up once I end this session, but if not, you'll get a follow-up email in a couple of days. But please take the time to fill out the survey. Let us know what you liked, what we can improve on, your ideas, and just anything that you guys have on your minds. We really would love to hear from you. Also, don't forget, follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And then last but not least, you have to join us next week for our last episode at 2 o'clock Eastern time. And it's called Stop and Smell the Rosé, Sipping and Debriefing, our inaugural series. So I will be back to moderate a lovely chat with the Queen Quayla, the Zen Frankie, and the Advocate Kala. We talk about their experiences being a host, what they've learned, and a fun recap of each episode, including food and a little drink. So you won't want to miss it. Again, thank you guys so much for joining us today, and I hope everyone has a good day, and we will see you next week. Thanks guys.
So much. Bye.
Thank you.